Hi, everybody, and welcome to today's TOC podcast. I'm Joe Weichert, chair of O'Reilly's Tools of Change Conference. Today's podcast is brought to you by Publishers Weekly, our TOC event partner. TOC now has a regular column in Publishers Weekly called Perspectives, and you can keep up with those perspective articles both on publishersweekly.com and in their print edition. I'm joined today by Simon Lipscar, president of Writer's House, a literary agency, and I asked Simon to join us because our TOC theme this month is pricing. And Simon wrote a terrific letter to the Department of Justice challenging the logic behind their proposed settlement of the suit against Apple and five of the big six publishers. Simon's letter dispels some myths about what he refers to as the actual price consequences of the agency model. So Simon, welcome to this TOC podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So Simon, let's start off with you telling us a bit about what you do and how you're involved in the book publishing industry.
Sure. Well, I'm a literary agent. So, you know, my role in the industry is obviously primarily, or actually solely, as an author's advocate. I like to think that what authors find valuable is also what publishers find valuable and other people in the food chain find valuable is that we work very hard here, and I work very hard to be incredibly knowledgeable about the actualities of the publishing business and to be real professionals who nonetheless are looking after the interests of writers as opposed to any other corporate interests. So, you know, one of the nice things about agencies and the agent relationship that I've always really treasured is that we have a very clear legal responsibility as a fiduciary for our clients to put their interests above our own. And I love that because it allows a real clarity and purity of purpose, and it also allows our place in the industry, when we're informed and knowledgeable, to be both incredibly powerful as advocates and incredibly useful as partners, I think, for the publishers and other people who we work with in the publishing food chain.
Okay, so let's dig into the meat of this. What is your opinion of the DOJ's proposed settlement terms, and in particular, how the agency model has affected ebook prices?
Well, you already sort of you already tipped your hand,
okay,
or my hand with your lead-in. But look, obviously, I'm fairly clearly on public record as thinking very poorly of the settlement terms, specifically as they relate to the discount restrictions. And the reason I have issues with that is because I think, to answer the second question first, and then to circle back to the DOJ. I think that the DOJ has gotten the data profoundly wrong. I think they have clearly misread the landscape of ebook pricing, and they've done so for reasons that there's two ways they could have done so. From, you know, with retrospect, and even since I wrote the letter back in May, I've had a lot of time to think about this and a lot of interesting conversations. And so I'd put it like this. There are two rational ways that you can come to understand their basic position. And their basic position is that ebook prices have gone up as a consequence of the alleged illegal collusion.
Right.
So for the purpose of this conversation, let's not worry about alleged and illegal collusion. We're just gonna talk about the pricing. I'm not interested or capable or have any authority or expertise on analyzing the questions of whether there was collusion or there wasn't collusion or whether it is defined as collusion under the law. I think that's not what you want me to talk about, and it's not relevant.
Right.
But we're not gonna, let's skip over all that, those issues. But in terms of the question of price, so their allegation or their statement, their statement based on their investigation of the ebook marketplace is that prices went up. But in actuality, when you read what they wrote in their competitive impact statement, which was filed along with the lawsuit and the final judgment order, which is the settlement document, a proposed final judgment order, they basically, what they do is they say, this set of titles went up in price. And the titles they're interested in are books that had been priced at $9.99 for consumers by retailers, that moved from $9.99 to $12.99 because of the shift from a wholesale model to an agency model.
Right.
And those books in specific were new release hardcover bestsellers. And at the interesting thing I found about the document is that at the opening of their analysis of the marketplace, they're very specific and clear that those are the books that went up in price. But that's the last time that that specificity exists. And from then on, that specific situation is turned into a general marker for the entire landscape. And mm-hmm. prices went up when, in fact, all they've generally proven or demonstrated is that specific prices went up. So my I did an analysis in my letter that looked at current prices of the bestseller list on the Kindle bookstore on one day. And I could, and the only reason I did it in one day was very simple. I don't have lots of data access. I don't, you know, I'm a literary agent. I don't have the tools, the data systems, the infrastructure to have been to be absorbing price information on a regular basis. It wouldn't be productive for my clients. It'd be a waste of their time for me to be doing that. So I did an analysis of one day, and you know, some people have criticized that, saying, well, that's a very shallow analysis, but I actually meant it as a shallow analysis specifically to encourage the DOJ to realize that if one day on the Amazon Kindle bestseller list, one day demonstrated that the average price was lower than it had been before agency, mm-hmm. then shouldn't that imply that you might want to take a deeper look at the basic assertion that they're making?
Right.
And by the way, I want to go back and say there's two separate assertions here. Beyond the one about the specific set of titles, we could also talk about the question of, and I only analyzed the question of, did ebook best-selling prices go up on average? But you could also ask the question, did ebook prices on average go up across the entire market? So since that time, I've had a lot of conversations. I've talked to people who have much more access to data than I do. And I am more convinced than ever that there is absolute data proof that both ebook prices generally have gone down since the introduction of agency. So consumers are paying less on average for ebooks. And two, that the average price for ebook bestsellers has gone down a little. Now, it might be flat, it might be a little, that's a little bit of a nuance. It hasn't gone significantly down, it hasn't gone up. There was a spike that was clearly demonstrated right after the introduction of agency, and in the two plus years since then, there's been a return to the original price. And in my letter, I analyze, we can get back into this, I suggest some reasons why that might be the case. All right, but to go back to what I was saying, there's probably two reasons why the DOJ would come to the conclusion they came to. The first is that they defined the data set very, very narrowly. And that if you define the data set narrowly and say, we define the question of whether ebook prices went up by asking the question, did new release hardcover ebook prices go up? Then the answer is yes, they did. So obviously, if they have convinced themselves that that narrow definition is in fact a fair definition, that would lead them to some of the conclusions that they've been led to in their pursuit of in their arguments about the consequences to the market and subsequently why they would insist upon elimination of price controls by the settling publishers for a period of 2 years. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
The other reason that they would come to that conclusion is also very interesting, and that the other reason they come to that conclusion is because they would have come to the conclusion that theoretically, as opposed to practically, but theoretically, one would assume that collusive manipulation of price and moving it up would have long-term impact of raising prices generally, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, in theory, the act of several publishers at the same time to raise the prices that consumers paid for books and to control that price would by definite, you know, there's a theory, you could make a theoretical argument that would over the long term raise ebook prices. Now, one of the ways that they would raise ebook prices is if those parties, and this is, now we're talking the general market, right, a wide definition.
Yep.
One of the reasons that would happen is if under economic definitions, those parties had what's called market force, meaning they could control the price by their behavior.
Yep.
So, I actually think that to take those two examples, those two possibilities, which are I think have to be the two realistic ones, I think that's where the whole thing falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that narrow definition on the first example is so narrow to focus on such a thin sliver of titles, it doesn't feel compelling to me on any kind of a rational basis that is an adequate analysis of a marketplace and overall effects. And we're talking about a marketplace made up of literally hundreds of thousands of products and consumers buying hundreds of thousands of products, not only the thin sliver of titles. It just doesn't, I don't think it passes the smell test. Yeah. as an accurate way of looking at the market. The second one is interesting because it's a very logical economic theoretical, but it didn't happen, right? So even though you could argue that it would lead to that, it didn't lead to that.
Right.
And it's not leading to that is based upon a simple fact, which I alluded to before, which is that it turns out that the five original agency publishers, and now even with the sixth being Random House a year later, actually, despite our impression of their size, do not have market power. They don't have the ability to control the overall price of the market because they don't have market power. So there is, so those two things, I mean, now what's frustrating to me about the DOJ is it doesn't seem that that's that complicated to take those two possibilities and say neither of them make sense and they don't add up given the data. And so but nonetheless, they pursued the case exactly like one of those two things was right. Their logic.
So
the other possibility, which exceeds even my boundaries for cynicism, is that they know full well that the case they're making is false and are doing it to put some trophies on the wall. I struggle with that one. I guess I'm enough of an optimist to think that the U.S. government is not knowingly targeting industry with what they know to be a false argument.
Right.
So anyway, the upshot of this is if you look at the data the way I look at it and that others have looked at it with better data than I have and have said, you know what, there isn't a general rise in price, there isn't a general rise in price for bestsellers, and there's actually a clear and significant drop in price for overall title count, across overall title count. It means that, you know, to go back to the first part of your question, that the settlement term that they pursued, they must have pursued with great vigor because I'm sure that the settling publishers resisted it with equal vigor, was the term that strips away their price controls for a period of 2 years. I think that is in a completely illogical thing to have in a settlement, because what it says is, because you did wrong, we are now going to insist on a cure for a situation that actually we can't even identify, or no one can rationally identify that there was harm. Mm-hmm. But we're going to insist on that cure anyway. And what's frustrating to me about that is that they're playing God. They're saying, we think that prices might have got even lower if you hadn't done this, which is possible,
right.
But they only think it.
Yeah.
And it's possible speculatively. It's also possible speculatively that this will indeed lead to lower prices now. It also might not. But I don't think it's the DOJ's. I don't think the law, though I'm not a lawyer, I don't think the law gives the DOJ the right to play God in terms of hoping for outcomes that are not demonstrated by present, you know, present situations. It's fairly clear that what they've asked for flies in the face of the logic of the data of the market over a good, healthy 2.5 year period in which there was really significant growth in the market. We were able to see, I think it's not a mature market for sure, but it's a maturing market as opposed to an absolutely new market now. And we have a much better sense of things. I just don't think their data holds. And as a consequence, I think that their desire to eliminate those price controls, which they admit are completely illegal, and after 2 years, everyone's allowed to go back right on full-on agency again.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's wrong-headed. I think it's bad for the market. I think it's bad for the consumer in the long run. I think it's not in the public interest. And as a consequence, I hope dearly that Judge Denise Coate, who ultimately has the authority to approve the settlement, looks at all the comments that were submitted by myself, by Barnes & Noble, which had significant data points, and says, I don't buy this. This doesn't look real to me.
I want to go back to something you said there about control and so forth. But first, let me just remind everybody that today's podcast is brought to you by TOC's event partner, Publishers Weekly. And I'm speaking with Simon Lipscar, president of the literary agency Writers House. So, Simon, you mentioned this whole notion of control, and as you were talking about that, one thing that went through my mind, well, actually two things. One is, I can't tell you the last time I bought an ebook from one of the big six, frankly. I mean, and that leads into point number two. there's so much more competition now in the ebook space than there was in the print book world. And I would think it would have been probably easier for the Big Six to control pricing in a physical bookstore with print books than it is in the ebook world. And in fact, as I look at the bestseller lists on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and elsewhere, you see so many titles that are out there for like $2 and $3 that are blockbusters, self-published titles, or deeply discounted titles. And so I've got to believe that, as you're saying, that prices probably are continuing to come down just because, number one, there's this mix of other lower priced titles out there. But secondly, I think that consumers have so much choice now, and to get back to your point, that the Big Six really can't control the industry, and that prices are going to be where they are, and consumers are going to pick and choose. If they want to pay a premium for a title from a Big Six publisher, then they will. But in my case, I've just gone for the titles that I'm interested in, and coincidentally, because there's so much else out there, they haven't been Big Six ones.
I in essence, you just made the argument that I made in my letter to my Taniak letter, which was to say that I think that the reason why prices have come down, even on the bestseller list, if certain prices have gone up, is because there's been an absolute explosion of competition in the digital space, as one would expect. I mean, as one would expect for two reasons. One is because the barrier for entry in digital is much lower than for print, and so it's not surprising that we're seeing new competition, but that's sort of obvious. The thing that should be equally obvious is that if consumers are seeing prices that are raised above what they expect to pay, it by definition creates a contrarian price opportunity for an explosion of content at a lower price point, which increases in its value in proportion to how far that price is away from other desirable content, right? In other words, if a $2.99 book is sitting on the bestseller list next to a $12.99 ebook, the differential there is really significant, right? If it's sitting next to that same book is priced $7.99, is that differential great enough to cause the proportional value? One of the things that I found really fascinating about the whole debate that came out of the Taniak process is that I'm just gonna say this, I don't view them as my opponents in this, but many self-published authors took a very, very negative view of industry defense of, or not defense, because I wasn't defending the publishers, industry concern about the settlement terms. And they in fact, the largest group of Taniak letters that were in support of the settlement came from self-published authors who have, I think, explicitly benefited from this opportunity, which I find really ironic.
Yeah.
And interesting, and I think some conversations about that could lead to some really interesting thoughts about where this business is going and why there's this division, because a huge number of authors who are published also wrote in, and they were uniform, I would say, in their disappointment with the DOJ and request that these terms be struck. So we have a real division now, I think, in the author community between those who earn their livings by taking advances and being published by publishers and those who self-publish. But it is an interesting thing. That's all sort of a sidebar to say, I think you're right. I mean, I think there's no question that low-priced content, whether self-published from new publishers, from wholesale publishers whose offerings retailers have the opportunity to to price below cost or at any price they want, really, have exploded the market. And that explosion has had profound consequences on the prices that consumers pay. I think it's really interesting that you said that you haven't felt compelled to buy a $12.99 new release hardcover ebook. You can't remember the last time because you feel like you've had other content other books that have been satisfying to you or have been equally compelling to you or maybe more compelling to you, mm-hmm. and the price mattered. One thing I will say though, that just to color that for a second, is a lot of books, and this is sort of reverse of what I'm saying, but I think it makes the point in an important way. One of the things that I've been saying ever since the advent of agency is we found from the advent of agency, before the rise of actual ebook sales, one of the things that was said very broadly amongst those who talked about the possibility of an ebook business was that there would unquestionably be resistance from consumers to high ebook prices. And right. There was this kind of psychological barrier at $9.99, whether that was erected by Amazon when it launched the Kindle, or even if it pre-existed. I think it actually pre-existed Amazon. There would have been talk about that price point, which of course is arbitrary, but psychology is somewhat arbitrary, as being a real, like, if you go above this price, you will stump the market. People will not buy these books. People don't want to do it. So one of the things that I think we've learned about the ebook marketplace is high prices will create aggressive competition at low price. Mm. We've also learned that high prices will not prevent consumers from acquiring content that they want. Jeff Bezos is very proud of the explosion of the growth of the KDP, the Kindle Direct publishing program on Amazon. And I think the last time he announced numbers, he said that 22 of the books on that list, of the top 100 books for that last month, were self-published through KDP. And, you know, he took a lot of pride in the fact that he's helped to give authors this opportunity and that they've had such success on his platform. What's fascinating to me about that is the unspoken side of that is that 78 of those books were published by publishers. Mm. And I would say the majority of those were published by publishers who are under agency and whose prices were higher than those in the know thought were going to be the acceptable price for ebooks. So, which actually to me is exactly what should be happening. What we should be seeing is a real diversity of price in the marketplace. Right. We should be seeing consumer choice around that. We should see consumers being given the opportunity to opt for lower price content or higher price content, or to opt for both, to decide when it's worth it to them to pay for, you know, premium content. But I will admit that since we're talking about pricing, one of the things that has concerned me most about this whole environment is the implicit stance of the Department of Justice that they want to see ebook prices commoditized at the lowest possible price. Because as, you know, if prices shrink, at a certain point there's no barrier below they can go, or else there's no business for anybody. Right. And at that point you have a commodity where all things are priced the same. And from my point of view, an economic point of view, to see cultural product commoditized like that is profoundly bad for authors. It's profoundly bad for readers. It's profoundly bad for literary culture, though I don't want to be too grandiose. And I think it's actually really bad economics, and that will have lasting negative consequences for consumers. That said, I'm sure it would have lasting negative consequences for authors, and they're what I wake up in the morning thinking about. I wake up in the morning, as I said up front, thinking about how I use my position and my knowledge of the business to advocate and to create opportunity for authors, so that not only today but in the future their interests are preserved. And if I see that the governmental position is indicating that a trend that would lead to commoditized book price, even if it's not $2.99, even if it's $3.99, that's not the issue. That, by definition, I think is very unhealthy for consumers and for authors. And I'm going to fight, you know, I'm going to fight fiercely against anything that leads to that possibility.
Yeah. Okay.
Well,
let me shift gears for a moment, because you know, as I think about this, there really aren't that many industries, I should say, where the maker of the product, in this case the publisher, gets to set the final price that the customer pays. And more often than not, you have a model where there's a list price that the maker sets, and then the retailers approve to basically discount as they see fit. So with the agency model, since the publisher can set the price, is that a good thing, do you think, to keep that power in the publisher's hands?
Well, listen, that's a really, really interesting question. And that's a philosophical question as much as an economic question. So let me approach it a couple of ways. First of all, I think that your question is interesting on its face because it's about a world that we believe in inherently, because it's the world that is tangible to us and we grew up with, which is the world of physical product. And I think that, in fact, in the digital world today, you can't even say as directly as you just said that this is how it's usually done. You and I can both come up with many, many examples as of today in which producers, whether they be the creators themselves or their licensees who are the publishers or music labels or whoever they are setting price for their content. We see it in movies, we see it in music, we see it, and I think most powerfully, of course, we see it in the app business, which is such a powerful economic engine in terms of, you know, people's experience of tablets and computing these days. Those prices are, of course, all set by the software developers and by the companies that make the software. And I think that the reason why it works, not only is because it, I mean, frankly, it benefits Apple, which is the reason they are so, they embrace this model, is because they love getting to extract a toll for existence on a platform that they create without having to do any work to support, you know, the, or support or market the individual products. Right. I mean, that's, if you've created the world's best platform and you can charge 30% to everyone for the pleasure of being there, that's a pretty sweet business. And yeah, in fact, there's a reason they're the largest company in America, because they've got a pretty sweet business and they're darn good at what they do. But I do think that to switch gears on the question for a second, we're seeing it happen, but there's, and we're not only seeing it happen because it's, it can happen because an Apple can say, I don't want to take risk, I don't want to own your property and then resell it. I want you to hold the risk and I want to take a toll. It's also because there's something inherently different about ebooks, or, I mean, let's talk about ebooks as opposed to general digital content. There's something different from ebooks and books, which is, and this is not my insight, and so I want to give credit where credit's due, but Bob Cohn in his Tiny Act comment, I don't know if you've spoken to him yet, but Bob Cohn in his really quite spectacular comment did a profound analysis of the mistaken logic behind seeing an ebook as a book. And the reason why is because a physical book is two things simultaneously. It is the delivery of, it is the form and packaging and delivery of content, the way we consume it, and the content itself. But it's inherent to the notion of books and copyright that the content is not the format it is delivered in. The content is not the packaging, it's not the delivery system, it's not the platform on which it's consumed. It's that aspect of what a consumer buys when they buy a novel. If you buy a novel by an author, you're not, yes, you are in physical form, you're buying a hardcover, but what you're, but that's just, a, you're paying for both a delivery system, and underneath that delivery system, you're paying for the novel itself, which is right, an abstract thing, the words and it's the experience. So why does that matter? That matters because in an ebook world, when an ebook file is delivered, that delivery of the file is only the delivery of the content itself, right? Mm-hmm. The platform and the experience has been delivered by someone else, a hardware provider, a ebook retail platform. So that whole, the book part of it, the physical book part of it, has been stripped away from the content part of it. And the reason that's important is because it raises the issue that the question you're asking is, I'd rephrase the question you're asking, which is, it's not that, is it the right thing because it's not been how we've done it before, but is it the right thing for a world in which publishers are delivering only one part, the more important part, but yeah, one part of that package to consumers?
Right.
And in that regard, I would, you know, so I have an opinion on that, which is that it is. I think it makes enormous sense for authors and their licensees, the publishers, to have pricing control over that part, because they don't and will never have pricing control over the platform. They will never have control over the management of the platform, the marketing of that platform, the reach and scope of that platform, the behavior of the parties that control that platform, and it simply makes sense to protect the inherent value. And the reason why is very simple. So take the next step. If that book, what the book is, has been split in two, the party that is delivering, and I don't mean this in any negative way, I just mean as hard, cold analysis, the party that is delivering the product, meaning the hardware, the platform, etc., they, by definition, would like maximum value associated with that part.
Right.
And publishers and authors by definition want maximum value associated with the content. But that is not a stable issue. That is, those two things do not live in total happiness together. There is inevitable conflict over how much value goes to each side of that experience. And so, as someone who's interested in the authorial side of it, by definition, I'd like to see control over the price, not of the entire experience, but just of the delivery of the not delivery, but the value and price of the content itself, separated from the entire delivery experience.
Gotcha. Yep. No, that makes sense. So last question I've got for you, Simon. Amazon obviously is the 800-pound gorilla that we're dealing with these days. So can you see anyone else emerging to challenge their leadership position? I mean, can Barnes & Noble do it? Is there somebody else? Google? What do you think?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I am a on-the-record Amazon admirer. I think that they're a remarkable company. I think that the growth of what they've done can only sort of be awed by what they've accomplished. And they took brave steps when other people were talking about those steps. I vividly remember, you know, the experience 6 years ago, when they walked into our offices for the first time to show us under NDA at the time, the Kindle. And it was astonishing to realize that the thing that had prevented people from wanting to buy ebooks was the fact it was hard to get them on their devices. And their just kind of genius insight, it was so obvious the minute they said it, was we got to deliver it over the air. Mm-hmm. And that they had embedded 3G and made it invisible to the consumer, but made it instantaneous so that you could acquire content anywhere you were. I mean, we all looked around the room and were like, yep, they just hit it out of the park. This is it. Like, this was the moment where we're like, this is not going to be the Sony Reader. This is not going to be the Rocket Book. This is where the internet delivery system plus an over-the-air delivery system equals a consumer experience that's going to be really a home run for consumers. And it was obvious, and you know, it didn't take insight. I'm not congratulating ourselves for seeing that this was going to happen. I'm giving them credit for having had the bravery to take those chances and to develop the product and the insight to do it. But the question you're asking is there going to be competition? And I would say, first of all, there is competition. Barnes & Noble has taken a really significant piece of the ebook pie, and they've taken it very quickly. And I again would give them tremendous credit. They took enormous amount of risk by focusing so much of their physical store space around selling Nook mm-hmm. devices.
Right.
They realized, I think, you know, my take on that is they realized at a certain point that instead of feeling frustrated by the advantages that an online retailer had in the competition they were having with Amazon, they realized that there is actual advantage to physical store space because it makes it easy for consumers to buy a product if they see it.
Right.
And so they took advantage of their physical store asset and created a really tremendous place at the table. I mean, my estimate is, you know, like most people, is they're around 25% of the marketplace, and that's not a small percentage. I also think Apple has taken a significant piece of the pie at this point. I think they're probably somewhere in the 10% range, though obviously by title it can move all around.
Sure.
I'm talking in kind of big generic averages. So those are two real pieces, but I think you're asking, is Amazon going to be a majority share of the business forever, or is there going to be competition that leads to either those parties or new parties taking enough that it's more of a plurality share as opposed to majority share? To that, I would say I have two answers. One is I don't know. I would like to think that because it's healthy for a marketplace to have competition amongst parties that where there's not one with overwhelming power. I just think that that's sort of classic textbook economics, and we've seen that before and we'll see it again. So I'd love to see individual entities rise that take significant market share just for the health of the marketplace.
Right.
But I actually believe that the real next step for the industry that that is going to be interesting to see unfold is not the question of platform driven sales, but sort of distributed sales. And I think I know that there's a lot of thought being put into this.
What do you mean by that, by the way?
You know, in all sorts of places. But I think there's a real, the answer to your question is we are as likely to see share. Well, what I mean by is that I think there's a possibility that in the next five to 10 years, we're going to see some of the underlying structures of how we think about ebook selling change. And that we're going to see people who own content encourage the sale of ebooks in many more places than just bookstores, which of course is in their natural interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean, why is it inherently so that you couldn't buy an ebook from a blog that had just said, I read this book, I loved it, right?
Right.
So,
but do all paths lead back to Amazon still in that model, do you think?
Well, it's hard for me to even begin to analyze or guess at. And obviously, if, you know, Amazon's control over its own platform is a powerful one. The analog I'd give to that is that you know, Apple has an equal position in music or greater, and they have had no problem letting you buy content elsewhere and then consuming it through iTunes Music Store, through iTunes or on your iPod or your iPad or your iPhone. You can, you know, right now today you can buy MP3s on the Amazon Music Store and listen to them on your, right, you know, on your iPhone. You can create your own MP3s or your own AACs for that matter, and experience them in that environment. So Apple, I think, with its very powerful, some would say monopolistic position in that particular industry, has had no trouble seeing that it's in their consumer interest and thus in their interest to allow consumption of content acquired outside their store, because it ultimately reinforces the power of their platform.
Right.
So I'm not going to predict that Amazon's going to make the same choice, but I think it's certainly worth saying that, having seen it from Apple, it's worth imagining that that Amazon would make the same pro-consumer choice, that they would want consumers to feel good about the platform that they've bought as much as anything else, because mm-hmm. they're such a consumer-focused organization. And I really believe them when they say that they put the consumer at number one in their thought process. Now, that doesn't mean it'll be as easy an experience as the one-stop, one-click, you know, experience at Amazon. But I believe inherently that will start to change. And also, as new platforms arise, I think it's inherent that we're going to see more retail competition, not necessarily from large companies, but from distributed sales across many, many, many micro channels. And that's a guess. I think that would actually be really interesting and really healthy, and it would make what would be fascinating about that is it would actually shift the whole industry back to the, in a way, more to the independent bookstore model, which is where we started. You know, it would be the reverse side of this long arc from small independent bookstores to enormous corporations selling books, back to, you know, which now seems like it's even consolidating even more around even bigger, you know, corporations, back to the fact that digital, by definition, could be experienced anywhere and right. by anyone and sold by anyone. So I'm not predicting that outcome necessarily, but in terms of answering your question, I think what I mean is that I actually see multiple ways that significant share of the retail space could be taken by new parties. I'm not necessarily sure that it would happen, that one individual large corporation would necessarily take that. I can see multiple ways that either a group of companies or a very distributed model creates significant share or takes significant share from today's retail parties.
Yeah, I really like your description and vision of that whole distributed model, and you think that would maybe open the door for somebody else to perhaps step in and take a leadership role. So Simon Lipscar of Writer's House, thanks so much for talking to us today on this TOC podcast.